This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Nature of Jewish Power, Part 2. It's very apt that it is a Part 2 because I want to talk about the duality that surrounds Jewish power, the duplicity, the double think, and the double talk. Now, duality is the quality or character of being twofold. And duplicity is especially applicable to the Jews. It means contradictory doubleness of thought, speech, or action, especially the belying of one's true intentions by deceptive words or action. Now, the ultimate source, the root source of this duality is Jewish identity itself, and the very two-faced aspect, especially of a certain type of Jew. Now, there are, you could say, two types of Jew. The Zionist type, the type of Jew that prefers to live amongst Jews, even if only in concept, in their own mind. Not all Zionists actually live in the Jewish homeland in Israel. Many Zionists live elsewhere, but maybe the term calling these people, these Jews, Zionists, is kind of a misnomer there, because what I'm trying to distinguish here is the difference between the Jews who want to live amongst other Jews versus what seems like the vast majority of Jews is of a different sort, which I'll call diasporist. Although that's similar to the Zionist, I may be using that incorrectly or in a different sense than it's usually used. And those are the Jews who prefer to live amongst non-Jews, amongst the Goyim. And why they prefer one over the other, I won't get into in this installment. Just point out that there are these two different approaches that Jews take. Even amongst the diasporists, the ones who prefer to live amongst the Goyim, there are two types. There's the type of Jew that lives openly as a Jew versus the more assimilated Jews that adopt the appearance of the locals and try to pass themselves off as locals. Religion is often used as a cover, although its main use is as a system amongst the Orthodox Jews who take it seriously. It's used as a system of maintaining social and biological integrity and coherence, keeping their community together and insular. And it's hard to get to know those Jews because they are so insular and they don't interact much with outsiders. You can read about them, but it's difficult to get to know them personally. Whereas for the other kind of Jew, the more assimilated kind, religion is really just a cover. It's a disguise. It's an excuse for why the Jews are the way they are. Why do they seem so alien? Why do they set themselves apart? And usually it's the excuse is that, oh, it's a religious thing, and when it's not, really. The assimilated Jews pretend that Jewish identity is not significant, that it's not different, that it doesn't set Jews apart. And yet at the same time, Jews, even secular assimilated Jews, will often claim special moral authority as a Jew. That's the code phrase, or the magic phrase is, as a Jew, I think this or that. As a Jew, I have some special insight into this or that issue. It gives me the moral authority as a Jew to tell you how to see things, how to think. And these Jews, despite their divisions, despite their this dual identity, these various types of duality, they all join together in solidarity with other Jews to promote tolerance and combat anti-Semitism. These are two Jewish ways of waging war that I've spoken about in previous installments that are related to this one. Now, in the news, just on Monday, there was a story from Britain about Prince Charles, and the title was Prince Charles Warns of Rising Antisemitism. This was out of The Guardian. He made the comments in a speech that praised the work of Lord Sacks. This is a Jew that we've talked about previously. The outgoing chief rabbi. Charles said, running throughout your time as chief rabbi has been that all-important principle of which this country has long been an exponent, the principle of tolerance. I sometimes fear not enough recognition is given to the role of the faith communities in the life of our country in promoting such a critical principle, and I join with you in mounting anxiety at the apparent rise in anti-Semitism, along with other poisonous and debilitating forms of intolerance. And I wonder, when reading this, why Charles is expressing this concern for the best interests of such a small percentage of the population in Britain, such a small percentage of his subjects. But, of course, it's because of Jewish power that he does so. He doesn't have the same concern for native Britons who are literally being displaced and dispossessed from their own country. The Jews have a country in Israel, and if things ever get too bad in England, in Britain, many of them will go to Israel, if not somewhere else. But the native Britons don't really have another homeland to run off to. Tolerance is a critical principle for diaspora Jews, that the population, the host population amongst whom they live, is tolerant of having Jews around. And beyond that, of being ruled by Jews, of being told what to think, what they can do, what they can't do, and having these alien Jews doing their own thing amongst them, no matter how alien their practices are from the native population. That's what tolerance means. Tolerance is effectively the demand for deference from the majority population to the best interests of the minorities, quote-unquote minorities. It's a demand for subordination, the majority interests, really. Jews are the prototypical minority. Whenever you hear any talk about minorities and minority interests, minority rights, it's really the Jews that created that talk, created that idea. They are the template for it. And they often use other groups as proxies for themselves to promote their own interests. They often wrap themselves in these high-minded, quote-unquote, principles of tolerance, promoting tolerance, as if they're promoting other people's interests and not just their own. This tolerance is what's truly poisonous and debilitating. You know, Charles used those words, and this is part of how Jewish power works, is they flip it around. It's not us that should be concerned about their poisonous, debilitating harm that they're doing to our societies. We're all supposed to be concerned about what they think is harming them, what they consider poisonous or debilitating to them. I find it amazing that Charles actually used that word poisonous, considering that in the first installment in this series, I talked about that being the one word that really sums up the nature of Jewish power. And the use of poison as a secret weapon, that it's not a weapon that's used openly, is especially fitting here too, and it fits with the Jewish modus operandi, the way they do things, their general tactics, not being upfront and being duplicitous. Now, a little later in the article, it says in his speech, Sachs was due to describe his 22 years as chief rabbi as the most exciting and fulfilling of his life, but he was also expected to issue a warning over the number of Jews who do not have a Jewish marriage and the growth of so-called ultra-Orthodoxy. Now the Orthodox are obnoxiously intolerant of all the Jews. They're the most obnoxiously intolerant if you ever do have a contact with them. Ultra-Orthodox just means that the ultra-obnoxiously intolerant. And this intolerance queers this whole public call by the rabbi, the chief rabbi here, for tolerance. It makes it plain, this duality of the Jews, that in reality, the Jewiest Jews of all are the most intolerant people. And so you have this exposed, and that's why he's upset about ultra-Orthodoxy. And the fact that he's upset, Sachs is upset and denounces intermarriage. This is a Jewish code word that effectively means race mixing, miscegenation. If it was white people talking about it, and even if we tried to use the code word intermarriage, it would be identified as discrimination, as exclusion, as hate, as racism, as supremacism. And in fact, it is. I mean, literally, Jews think they're better than non-Jews. And so, of course, Jews should seek out other Jews to marry, to continue the Jewish line. And a great deal of Jewish identity is about the shaming of one generation of Jews to their children to give them, to find Jewish spouses to marry, to give them Jewish grandchildren. So how do Jews deal with this schizophrenic identity that they have? Well, it comes out in double talk. It comes out in double think, duality. They have verbal skills, and this Talmudic pill pull, they call it, this hair-splitting tendency, that's where the double talk comes in, this ability to spin sensible stuff with nonsense, to say basically whatever they want, to justify whatever they want. Promoting tolerance and combating hate is maybe a good example of that, although those are relatively simple expressions. I'm thinking here more the double talk, the longer, their verbosity, their need to talk and talk and talk almost to make, you know, on purpose to make your eyes glaze over. I mentioned doublethink as well. This is an Orwellian term from George Orwell, who described it as, doublethink means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. And, you know, the reality is what I find so objectionable, and I think what most white people find objectionable about this idea of combating hate and promoting tolerance, is what it amounts to in reality is not upholding a principle against hate or a principle in favor of tolerance. It's what it really comes out as is hate for the haters and intolerance of the intolerant. And that sounds like nonsense, but what it really means is hate the haters, where haters is defined by Jews as whoever the Jews hate. That's who gets identified as a hater. And it's okay for everybody, including the Jews, to hate those people, and likewise with intolerance. And I mentioned Charles Jacobs. He's an American Jew who lives in America, who has this organization. I mentioned him during the Boston bombing, the blogging I did on the Boston bombing and the podcast I did concerning it. His organization is titled Peace and Tolerance or something. His website is peaceandtolerance.org. And his tagline is promoting peaceful coexistence in an ethnically diverse America. Well, on the sidebar of his about page, he has a quote from Karl Popper, the Jewish philosopher, explaining this. This is an example of double talk here. Unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed, and tolerance with them. We should therefore claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant. It sounds like gibberish, but you know, basically, this is Jewish reasoning. This is a good example of it, how they take a principle such as tolerance, and then they explain to you why it's got to have a big exception for the Jews, so that the Jews can be intolerant of whoever they please, while at the same time preaching tolerance to everybody else. And that's what this amounts to. Karl Popper in another source that I found had an ever-present fear of anti-Semitism. That shaped his thinking about things, and he's a very significant figure. Could probably do a podcast just on him and his the various things that he's said and people he's had influence on. But probably the biggest in this context is a book he wrote or two-volume set called The Open Society and Its Enemies. And the open society may be a phrase that's familiar to you. It's been taken up by a student of his named George Soros. And what the open society means essentially is liberal democracy. Popper equated it to liberal democracy. And what it means practically is open borders, anything goes, social politics, domestic social agenda. This is what's known as liberalism, at least in America. That's what's called liberalism. This tolerance of everything to the point of tolerating ourselves being replaced by aliens. Whites, you know, when we think of principles, we think of this famous saying that's attributed to Voltaire. Apparently it was not actually Voltaire who said this, but someone who was trying to sum up his thinking, his beliefs on freedom of thought and expression. You've probably heard this. I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And isn't that, I mean, that doesn't really capture every white man's thinking, but it certainly captures a strain of white thinking and the kind of white thinking that has led to accept these notions of promoting tolerance, even to the point of it subordinating our own interests, as long as it helps the Jews. You know, we accede to that. We meaning, you know, as a society. And you can see it in immigration. It comes out as, you know, I disapprove of your being in my country, but I will defend to the death your right to stay here. You see that attitude from conservatives, Republicans. The Jewish principle, a good example of a Jewish principle, and what they really literally consider a principle, is it good for the Jews? Tolerance is not really a principle, promoting tolerance for Jews. That's, you know, this example of Popper's explanation how tolerance has its limits. But, you know, is it good for the Jews is a really consistent principle. And in fact, it's the way to understand the apparent double standards that you see in the way Jews, what they preach versus what they practice. I've talked previously in some of my earlier installments about morality and the basis of morality and about the conflict between universalism and particularism. And this liberalism, liberal democracy that Jews push in recent decades, there's a duality there too. I mean, I talked at length about it in that podcast dedicated to it, but you know, basically they want whites to act as if it's our duty to uphold a society for everybody, to police the society, to protect everybody, to keep it safe and clean and pay the taxes so that everybody else can thrive. And that is, in fact, what's happening. Although white birth rates are down, everybody else's birth rates are up. Diversity is our greatest strength. This is a good example of the duality that we can see in everyday life, right in that slogan itself. White people mouth it, and it sounds crazy. It sounds stupid, because it is for white people. Diversity is our strength. No, it isn't. Diversity is destructive. Diversity is divisive. On its face, you can see that. But when a diversity mouths that diversity is our greatest strength, they're not lying. They're telling the truth. It's just that they have a different meaning of who us is and a different understanding of what diversity means. From a diversity's point of view, yeah, diversity is their greatest strength. Now, I talked in the last installment about how most white people don't understand Jewish power. They don't understand the nature of Jewish identity or the nature of Jewish power. And I want to add a corrective here, and I'll go into greater detail on this in the next installment. But I can start here by pointing out that I was thinking there and talking mainly about the masses, about everybody collectively, that you only find 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 of the people that you meet that actually understand what's going on with the Jews. The leadership is different. Amongst the elite, it's different. Amongst the people who actually interact with Jews, and especially, as I say, in the leadership and in the elite, you have to know about Jewish power in order to survive at that level. You can't, you might start off being oblivious to Jews and Jewish power, but you won't last that way. And a good example of that that you can see he understands Jewish power is Hegel. Chuck Hegel made comments about the Jews that got him into hot water, got him into controversy when he was nominated for Secretary of Defense. And how did he fix it? By sending personal letters, being obsequious and kowtowing essentially to Jewish senators, and by going to Jewish groups. Even before he had hearings in front of Congress, he had to basically go and kiss the ring and kiss the asses of these powerful Jews. And he knew who they were, and he knew what he had to say in order to get their approval, to get their stamp of approval. The double think going on with the Jews and Jewish power, in a nutshell, is that they pose as victims of oppression, as victims, really. And I've made the point many times that the oppression that they argue tell us that they've suffered is at the hands of whites, so that they actually consider whites their enemy. Well, in fact, they wield great power. And I don't know firsthand, going back throughout history, if they've always had this much power. I suspect not, but I also suspect that it hasn't really changed. That Jewish nature hasn't changed, that white nature hasn't changed much either. The ideas that animate us have changed. And certainly whites are on the losing side nowadays and dropping very rapidly in our power and our control, even over our own societies. And the Jews are very firmly now in power and in control. And I think going forward, I don't like to make predictions, but one prediction we can make about how this is going to play out is Jewish power is going to become so obvious that it won't be possible to deny it anymore. And so we'll see more and more of this Joe Biden type of public praise for Jewish power, public recognition of it, but only in the context of saying how wonderful it is, how great it is, how much we approve of it. And so these people, and again, I'll get into this more in the next installment, the people who want to deny that there is such a thing as Jewish power are going to be – they're going to have to change their tune, because it's going to be widely accepted that Jews do have power. And then the only position that will be permitted is to say that there's nothing wrong with that power. And even hiding behind code words like liberalism for Jewish power, or calling them communists, won't save you either, because they'll be able to – I mean, they already can see through that, but it will be clear that you're just unhappy with the things that they've done and are doing. Well, I've still got a few minutes here, so let me talk and just introduce that I want to talk about two men, Joe Sobrun, who's dead now, and John Derbyshire. Especially John Derbyshire, I've written a blog post about this past week, and I want to focus a little bit on what those men had to say, about Jewish power and what it means, and why I find it how it fits into this whole duality and the double talk and the double think that we see in Jewish power. I blogged about an article that Derbyshire had written titled "Be Nice or We'll Crush You," in which he begins. I didn't even quote this part, but I will now because I want to talk about this. He says, among the first things you hear from old hands when you go into opinion journalism in the U.S. is, to put it in the precise form I first heard it, don't fuck with the Jews. He writes that Joe Sobrun expressed it with his usual hyperbole, you must only ever write of us as a passive, powerless, historically oppressed minority, struggling to maintain our ancient identity in a world where all the odds are against us, poor helpless us, poor persecuted and beleaguered us. Otherwise, we will smash you to pieces. And that's where the title of that article comes from, which I don't think Derbyshire determined. I think it was this was in juicy.com, where it was published, and he was having an exchange with a Jew trying to convince him that even though he associated with people like Sobrun and Kevin MacDonald, that Derbyshire himself was very friendly to Jews and understood why they were the way they were and didn't hold it against them. But what Derbyshire and Sobrun, what they had to say actually means is that they acknowledge that Jews have power and that Jews are willing to use that power to punish the people that they perceive to be their enemies. There is, in fact, a worldwide Jewish conspiracy. It's a conspiracy to promote tolerance and to fight hate, to combat hate. And when recognition of this as a conflict of interest comes from those people who aren't Jewish, and they notice that it's Jews pushing this for the benefit of Jews and to our own detriment, we try to form opposition. And that's what gets identified as anti-Semitism. And that's when the Jews go into combating anti-Semitism mode. This is the nature of Jewish power.